Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hello, everyone out there in podcast universe. Thank you for joining us for Ogletree Deacons Podcast today. My name is Kevin Bland. I'm a shareholder in our Orange County office and focusing on workplace safety. Here with me today is lovely Ms. Karen Tynan, a shareholder here in our Sacramento office. We're going to talk today about California COVID prevention plans and the COVID-19 emergency temporary standard that was adopted. This is part two of three in this series, and this is a pretty deep dive into what the new Cal/OSHA COVID emergency regulation says, how to comply with it, and some best practices that we've found work well for it. So with that backdrop, Karen.
Let's roll up our sleeves.
Yes, we're ready. So Karen, you know, what are some of the examples of controls that we are required to do through the ETS or CPP standard, the COVID standard?
Well, as many of the listeners know, in the hierarchy of controls, which is used by workplace safety professionals, engineering controls and administrative controls are actually preferred to PPE. And our COVID prevention plan has very specific points and requirements for engineering controls. In our webinars, I know the hierarchy of controls is one of your favorite slides because we get to match up all the controls to what's being done.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated how that pyramid can balance on the point upside down. That's just my favorite part of it.
Yeah, didn't you learn that in second grade?
The food pyramid. If those of you can't see me, I'm about 300 plus pounds, so I'm big on the food pyramid.
There you go. So we've got engineering controls that are required in our CPP. And the first one I want to talk about is the use of solid partitions. This was a concept that was adopted pretty early on, Kevin, by a lot of our clients, especially in meat processing, the plexiglass barriers, and also adopted, I remember going to grocery stores in March.
Yeah, we saw that right away, didn't we?
Yeah, the plexiglass barriers and engineering controls are preferred really because they don't require the employee to take particular action. They can rely upon that control, right?
Absolutely. It's what I call a passive action, right? Yeah. You don't have to do anything. You just stand behind the plexiglass. It doesn't take an action on the employee's part. So tell me, what did Cal/OSHA do anything a little backwards maybe on this engineering control idea?
Well, it's funny because back to part one in our podcast, we talked about exposure, that 615-24 exposure. And in Cal/OSHA's definition of exposure, they did not consider whether or not you had a solid partition between people, who was COVID positive and a coworker. I think that partitions were not as fully explained as they could have been. We have been working with a lot of people they find different ways to address different exposure hazards. And partitions are particularly effective, Kevin. Mm-hmm. And whether it's plexiglass hanging from the ceiling between in a chicken processing plant, whether it is customer facing, all of that, it's used a lot, and I think we're seeing it as a very effective engineering control. Do you agree?
Yeah. Well, and the thing that was puzzling about, and we can talk a little bit in a minute, Karen, I'm going to ask you about the FAQ that dealt with this, but didn't the definition address this specifically, or maybe in another way, talked about masks, but didn't talk about partitions? What was your take on that?
Well, when the standard came out, one of the first things you and I talked about in the exposure definition was the fact that Exposure was defined as 6-15-24 contact, but you could not consider whether or not the person was wearing a mask. The definition did not include whether or not you could consider whether the person had a solid partition. So the fact that it particularly excluded mask, we felt, meant that it did not exclude considering partitions. And I would say, and you and I, we talked to our peers in our defense attorney group, and we have frequent calls about this. There was pretty much a general agreement, wouldn't you say, across the board in California?
Yeah, and based on just standard statutory construction, right? Plain meaning of what was said.
Right.
And so then what happened with the FAQs?
The FAQs came out in January and said completely the opposite and said you cannot consider whether a solid barrier was between the two people that you were evaluating exposure for. But that's not what the regulation says, Kev.
No, exactly. And so what happens when you have an FAQ that doesn't seem to be in line with what the law says?
Well, what we're trying to do as I have a great friend, she's from Germany. She calls it eating off both ends of the sausage. And so.
I like that. I don't know if I'll use it, but I like it.
So what we're saying is the plain language of the reg doesn't say that you can't consider barriers. The FAQs, when they line up with the interpretations we like, we say, ooh, look, the FAQs, isn't it great? And this is what Cal OSHA says. And when the FAQs don't line up like we like, we say, well, they're not law anyway.
Exactly.
So we are trying to eat off both ends of the sausage.
Yeah. My favorite, you can use it as a shield or a sword.
Yep. And so that's what we're doing with the FAQs, is using them as a shield and a sword. And on the solid partition issue, that's what we're doing. Another engineering control that I'm hearing a little bit of a struggle around is the maximizing outside air. People have been dealing with their HVAC systems and trying to maximize air, but certainly in some situations, banks, that's a good example.
Yeah.
Very difficult because of security measures.
Right.
Also in plants that have a temperature requirement for the food they're working on.
Yeah.
So you have food safety requirements meeting outside air ventilation requirements that don't really mesh. And it's a problem for quite a few employers in the engineering controls. I do want to have time to talk about administrative controls. But so many people are familiar. Administrative controls are the physical distancing. We've been doing that since February, March, right?
Six feet. Yep. See the little signs on the floor, right?
The little X's on the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
Only allowing, you know, one person in a bathroom at a time, even if it's, you know, a four stall bathroom.
And at age over 55, that's a problem for me sometimes.
Absolutely. The administrative controls of cleaning and disinfecting. We've been doing that since February also, February, March. Many employers have what I would call enhanced sanitation, where they're bringing in bigger crews for a daily cleaning and cleaning throughout the day, and providing employees cleaning materials so that they can clean machines, doorknob, things that they're touching.
Well, and we've had some clients, Karen, too, that like in order to help, remember in podcast one, we talked about working groups. And so like they have the lunch room, they will completely sanitize it between groups for lunch so that that group doesn't cross-pollinate with the next group that comes in. And so that's been, I had some success. Those are the folks that aren't sending them to their car to eat lunch by themselves.
Right. And so it's fun for Kevin and I, because we get to mention these ideas that we've actually gotten from clients. I didn't come up with ideas about bracelets or colored duct tape on the floor. Clients said to me after we talked about zones, hey, we found all these different duct tape colors. We're going to, in the entire distribution center, the floors are color coded now.
Yeah. Oh. And it's hard to tape a duck because the feathers, they don't want to stick. No, that was a bad joke.
No, that's pretty good, actually. So those are some of the administrative controls that are required. But that doesn't include CPP requirements for PPE in the CPP.
What, right. And that leads to my next question for you, Karen. We've talked a lot about the engineering controls and the hierarchy of controls. So at the bottom of the pyramid, at the point, is PPE. And, I know now I talk about PPE and everybody in the country knows what it means until COVID. Right. I talk about PPE and they go, what the heck are you talking about, just safety geek? So anyway, let's talk about the PPE requirements under the CPP and how that works.
So PPE, which people are very familiar with now, personal protective equipment, has to be addressed in the CPP. And what employers are required to do under the plan is to evaluate their workplace for what PPE is required. Obviously, face coverings are the most visible PPE that we see every day. And the CPP actually introduced that new term, Kevin. Before that, face coverings was not used in any Title VIII reg, was it?
No, not at all. And interesting enough, we call them face masks, face coverings, bandanas, which aren't a face covering, right, according to Cal OSHA, gaiters. I didn't know what a gaiter is. I thought someone would bite me, and all of a sudden, right, now I find it somewhere around the face. So, yeah, that is a new term that's been introduced, but it's defined now,
yes,
right? So how's that work?
So the face coverings have a definition, and Kevin's correct. It's not just pulling your shirt up on your face or the gaiters. And most companies are using the fabric mask or the surgical mask as their way of providing face coverings. And it does have to be provided. And so having employees go out and purchase their own, you just can't require that, right? Yeah. Some people have preferences. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I think in one of our other podcasts, we talked about, what if an employee wants to bring their own N95 to work, things like that. So right now, the regulation talks about face coverings, and it does not mean an N95 mask.
Let me throw this question out at you.
Uh-oh.
Okay. So what happens, Cal OSHA comes in the door, and they say, and they're wanting to, explain what they do, and they say, we require everyone to wear N95. What happens then? Is that a face covering?
Interestingly enough, an N95 falls under a different regulation, right?
Exactly.
And you, because of your construction background, me, I was in the maritime industry, we had N95s, right?
Yeah.
And it falls under the respirator standard. And so there's been a real conflation of terms, is what I would call it. And so businesses really need to, in their CPP, understand these terms. There's a ton of great materials on the Cal OSHA website. I'll give them that, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one point to follow up on that, what I want to make is that it's great if people want to wear N95s as a face covering. And the reason I worded it that way was because it would say, we require N95s. That means you require respirators. Everybody clean shaven, medical check, fit test, brand specific to each individual. That's where when you require it. But if you are requiring face coverings and someone chooses to wear one, and I think that's important because I've heard some people, they want to sound, when Cal OSHA, hey, we're doing, and it opens up a can of worms. So that's one thing you can take away. Face coverings, good. It's not to mean you can't if you in some cases, they are wearing and they have the fit test, like in some nursing homes, I've seen it in hospitals. Absolutely. We'll get into that subject, ATD, but those are respirators. They may be worn as a face covering and they are a respirator if you're requiring N95. Yes. There's a voluntary portion in the regulation. We're getting way in the weeds and you can have a voluntary program, but just call them face coverings. And if they want to, and if you provide an N95 as quote unquote a face covering in your program, it's a face covering, not an N95 respirator. Sorry, I got off on a tangent, but
I think that's a good point. And we talked about it back in our podcast. I think it was in April or May, because there was such a conflation of terms and people wanted to go out and buy N95s and put them on a table in the break room and say, here's your mask, not realizing that they're respirators and there are a ton of requirements within 95s.
Absolutely. One other point on PPE, and this is a new one I haven't even had a chance to talk to you about, just happened the other day, is that it's a public-facing company with some retail stores and some hospitality things, and they were having deaf clients come in, and they couldn't read the lips, and so what are they going to do? And so there is a provision under there, but to allow them, if you have other administrative controls, like you talked about earlier, to allow them to take it off. So in other words, they maintain 6 feet or 7 feet or whatever rule you make up for that. Are they getting these clear face masks? But if you get the clear ones, it can't be a face shield because it doesn't require, make sure it meets that face mask requirement. And there was just a very large shoe company that just lost a lawsuit on that point. So it's an important, that's why I bring it up.
It's a good point. And if people couldn't tell, you were making all kind of motions for the face coverings and how it would fit over your face and the mask and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a good one, Kev.
All right, Karen. So here's one we get a ton on. Oof. And I'm glad I'm asking you this question, not as me, so that you can be on the hot seat. So reporting and record keeping, that seems to be a top priority for many employers in California, actually in the country. But so what are some of those requirements and kind of big picture about those two topics, record keeping and reporting of serious illnesses?
So first and foremost, your OSHA 300 log and the requirement that you report to Cal OSHA hospitalizations and fatalities, that has not changed, right, Kevin?
Bingo. Ding, 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 ding. Right. That law has not changed under COVID.
So many employers somehow, I think there may be some articles online, somehow got the impression that you just recorded and reported everything, kind of let Cal OSHA sort it out. That's not what happens. There is a requirement for the employers to keep track of COVID cases in the workplace. Well, that foundationally requires that you make a good faith analysis of whether or not Steve got COVID in the workplace, or was it in another way that requires an interview with Steve, maybe talking to some of his coworkers, maybe looking at video, figuring out, oh, are there any other coworkers with COVID? Is community spread really bad in our working area? So the kind of default where I think many people in the summer and before the end of 2020 were just recording everything on the 300 log and just figuring, well,
or recording nothing. We had
a few of those. Neither of those is an appropriate solution. And so you've got to make that good faith analysis and figure out whether or not the COVID case is work related. And you've got those same OSHA 300 log recording requirements. And in the case of local health department reporting in outbreaks, or if a local health department requires reporting, the CPP says you have to comply with that.
So I get this call all the time. Is that, hey, man, I got three COVID cases at my location. Who do I report to at Cal OSHA? I have to report that to Cal OSHA. I don't know who to call at Cal OSHA to report that. I know what I tell them. I want you to tell them what I should tell them.
First, I tell them to slow down a little. That we need to know where the three people got COVID. We need to understand, is it work related? And especially for the first person that has it in your workplace, I think sometimes they're referred to as patient zero or your first case. You may not be able to determine whether or not that's work related. They may have traveled or had community contact. And so telling people to slow down a little and to figure out where people got COVID before they try to figure out who they need to report to is absolutely critical.
Yeah. But, and to that point of reporting, you don't have to report a COVID case to Cal OSHA. When do you have to report a COVID case to Cal OSHA?
At hospitalization or at a fatality. And one of the issues many employers are running into is that they can't get information from the family or the person because their family isn't allowed at the hospital, right? So maybe the person is dropped off at the hospital. They don't know whether they're going to be admitted or not. So there's also an information vacuum that many HR professionals and safety managers are dealing with that is a barrier to proper reporting if you need to.
Yeah, it's interesting because, and by the way, the regulation says that when you knew or should have known through due diligence, that's when the clock starts ticking. But Cal OSHA seems to ignore that clause and say they were hospitalized at 10 o'clock on Tuesday night. That's when the clock starts, and you prove it otherwise. And interestingly enough, I had a fatality case with a client where the only citation they got out of that was late reporting because the person ended up actually dying, and they found out they died 2 days after they had died and reported it then. Right. But now we're going to have to go back and prove why we couldn't report it 2 days earlier. But the good news about that, that means everything else was in compliant at that particular. The only thing they could find was that reporting for $5,000, and so that was a good outcome in the context, right? A fatality, but it shows how Cal OSHA, that may be the only thing they find wrong,
right?
Is that reporting? Let's talk now about this is a big one, excluding COVID-19 cases from the workplace and excluding exposed workers from the workplace. How does that work? When do we have to take them out of the workplace, and how does that work?
So the CPP and the regulation require COVID-19 cases to be excluded from the workplace. If someone has COVID, they cannot come into your workplace. And if they're asymptomatic, because our governor issued an executive order, it can be as few as 10 days, right? 10 days.
Exactly.
If they're symptomatic, 14 days. But you've also got to consider that you have to exclude exposed workers. So back to the 615-24s, you're going to have to exclude those workers and stay in contact with them under the regulation, so that you can determine when they can return to work. I've seen some very clever and well-run clients who have like a big Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And it's actually color-coded. And they've got the red date for the first day. And then it's green after the 10 days, you know, on this big sheet with the dates and the specimen date and the symptom date and all that. Because it's very important to exclude people according to this regulation and to get it right. And so under this section of the CPP about excluding workers, there's also a requirement to pay earnings and maintain benefits. And that could be its whole podcast. And you and I could do that with Charles Thompson or one of our other guys here, Leslie Wallace. Let's just say the earnings maintaining is only for work-related COVID and work-related exposure. And with the layering of other state benefits and earnings substitutions, it can get a little complex.
Yes, I would say a little. I'd say very complex. and frankly, we have our own specialties, like you said, here that just work on leave and exclusion pay outside of the workplace safety arena. So if that happens, we recommend that, you know, if you have to exclude someone and you're trying to figure out the benefits, get a hold of someone that that knows how they're doing, because that's a very easy and tricky one to screw
up. Super tricky. And to close out, let me talk just a little bit, Kevin, about returning to work, because I talked about the 10 and 14 days. Sometimes our clients, and you'll hear people asking, oh, well, can I just get the employee to have a negative COVID test?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite questions.
Because you get to say no, Kevin. That's why you like that question.
Yeah, it's not very often I say no.
Right. So a very important caveat in the CPP and the applicable regulation is that you cannot require that negative test to return to work. So it's a super common question because people think it's a good idea. Oh, wow. Well, maybe I can just get the person tested. They'll get a negative test and they can come back. It makes sense on a human level and a year into the pandemic, but the regulation isn't allowing it.
Right. And it can't be required. The other thing, though, actually the reverse happens too sometimes because you can come back, right? You can come back even if you can't test negative, right? And you can get out of that exclusion pay because it's based on relief of symptoms.
Right.
And
it's
so,
number of days.
Yeah, so it's a little counterintuitive, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to Karen and I. Look for our blog articles on Ogletree.com. We have other recorded webinars related to COVID-19 that you can find on our website and other podcasts on different topics, as well as this was part two. Part one you should find on the podcast, the series. It's a three-part series. So stay tuned.
And stay safe, pretty please.
Have a great day.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.